just at the beginning, aren't we? We're kind of at the beginning, and I hope you're beginning to settle in a little bit. And I hope you remember what was kind of said at the in the sort of opening circle by myself, which really I was saying the main thing we need to learn to do, which isn't an easy thing, is to relax in a particular way. It's to relax a particular part of ourselves, in a sense, isn't it? It's to relax the part of ourselves that's trying to keep control of the situation, yeah. Which we all have, and it's completely understandable, and actually sometimes maybe it's very necessary, but from the point of view of what we're trying to do, it's not really very useful. But it's not an easy thing to do, just to stop trying to manipulate your experience, manipulate the world. Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do. So we also have to be very patient with ourselves. There's a kind of fundamental paradox that it struck me a long time ago, I suppose because of teaching and writing about meditation, you start to realise there's this fundamental kind of paradox involved in what we're doing. If, for instance, you look at the so-called five hindrances, which are very traditional Buddhist teaching, actually, in the end, they all come down to awareness. There's just different ways of talking about bringing more awareness to something. And basically, the whole process, the whole methodology of the process that we go through, basically it just comes down to awareness and love. So there's something, as I say, paradoxical involved, because we do practices to develop awareness and love, awareness and compassion. But actually, the only way we can develop awareness and compassion is through awareness and compassion. So that it's kind of circular, it's kind of paradoxical. And so, this is what we're working with, yeah? This is all we've really got. It doesn't matter, we can dress it up in all sorts of ways, and that's quite interesting. Well, it's not quite all we've got. The other thing that we've got is the imagination, or the other thing that's available to us, because it's wrong to think of it perhaps as we are our imagination. At least in the way I think me and Mandava are on the same, singing from the same hymn sheet here that actually this what we mean. The way we're talking about imagination is we're talking about the primacy of image in the psyche. Okay, that the psyche primarily manifests as image. Yeah, and perhaps right from the beginning we should say these images are not necessarily visual images. So images are far in this way of talking about images, far broader. It might be a sensation in the body, it might be a memory, it might be a thought, it might be all sorts of things. Dream, you know. Yes, we dream in images, don't we? But also, we dreams have a very particular atmosphere, which is sort of related to the image, but not the same as the visual image, yeah. In a dream, we kind of know, don't we, dreams have sort of mood or weather. This is also a kind of image, an emotional image, a felt image. So it doesn't matter how, I'm stressing this slightly because some people are very visual and as soon as they hear the word image, or they love it because they're good at that. And other people think, oh, I can't visualise, I don't have images. That isn't true. You've just got to find a way in which you do have images, which might be felt images in a sensation. Don't take, so we'll be saying this a lot, won't we? don't take image literally in this sense. Image just really means what the imagination does. To make image is what the imagination does, isn't it? It makes image. Or what the psyche does, it makes image. Anyway, don't worry. Hopefully that will come somewhat. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I was thinking, it will become clear, but of course a lot of this stuff isn't particularly clear. And this this attempt to bring too much clarity to something, we risk losing its depth, you know? Some parts of our psyche, some parts of our lives are sort of dark and deeply mysterious, and it's like when Hercules violates hell, doesn't he? He sort of brings light, this bright light down into hell. It's a sort of violation of, not hell, the underworld, I should say, the underworld. There's parts of us that don't bear the bright light of ego consciousness, you know, and it's a kind of more or less violation. We've got to learn to meet those parts on our own terms, and in some senses they'll always be somewhat murky, you know. We won't ever be able to pin them down, we won't ever be able to subject them to logical formula. They remain mysterious, you know, and that's just how it is. And a lot of what we're doing is quite mysterious, really. What are we doing? Mm-hmm. You know, why are we spending ages sitting on our arse? You must all think that sometimes, don't you? What am I doing? You know, I've been doing this, you know, well over 30 years now, and you know, sometimes I think, I don't know, I could have done a lot of things all that time sitting on my arse. But funny enough, the sitting on my ass seems to be increasingly the most meaningful thing to me. Even though I have done other things that I enjoy, I still do other things that I enjoy, but there's something about sitting with other people and not doing but somehow being that seems to me increasingly not because I think anything's going to happen, not because I think I'm going to get enlightened or something, you know. It's not because of that. Just inherently, intrinsically, to sit quietly, either by yourself, with other people, and just experience your experience. Just have awareness and love of what you experience. This is a very important part. What we can do for the imagination, somehow, there is this possibility of bringing awareness and love to your experience. And this is different than your experience being made up solely of nice things. Yeah? And I think this is what we're trying to somehow get to. So, when we experience shame or regret, anger, or when we experience positive things, we can just accept them in a way. We learn to hold them in a particular way. We learn to hold them in a particular way. And there's something about learning to hold our material in a particular way that seems to me extremely sort of valuable and experientially valuable. We experience it as valuable. When we become more ourselves, somehow we experience this as valuable. You know, it seems to be what we inherently want to be. We want to be ourselves. We want to be deeply who we are. Yeah, and this is somehow very valuable. So all the practices we're going to be doing here, and really the whole process is simply, put one way, simply becoming more comfortable and familiar and intimate with who we really are, who we feel we really are, what we really are. You know. the suggestion, of course, is that we're much more than our ego sense or our small self. That's the suggestion, isn't it? That actually this bit of us that wants to control experience and wants to... it's on the lookout, this vigilant part of us that's sort of, you know, it's useful, it's on the lookout, it's trying to protect us. But the implication of what I'm saying, I hope, is that there's much more to us than this. We do have to bring love and awareness to that over-vigilant, if we've got an over-vigilant ego, or if we've got a very insecure ego, or whatever, we've got to bring love and awareness to that. But we've also got to recognise that actually that's just quite a small part of us. I say us, I don't even know what us is. I mean, I think that's the thing in the end, what we are is quite mysterious, really. And we're trying to open that up. We're not trying to come to some definition or understanding of what we are. I think we're just trying to continuously open up our understanding of who and what we are. And if we see that on an emotional level, a psychological level, we're trying to become more, increase our capacity, really. Increase our capacity. So we can experience a broader and deeper, more intense range of ourselves without it destabilizing us. Without it, perhaps, pathologizing through the body or pathologizing within relationships. However, see, all this stuff in the end gets out. It all gets out. The question is just how does it get out? Yeah, how does it get out? Sometimes it gets out by, you know, we have a... Well, I don't need to say this really, because you all have your own stories, don't you? And your story is how this material gets out. And what I'm suggesting is that that story can be opened up, it can be re-understood, it can be brought into the world in a different way, in a more beautiful, with more kindness, you know. Still a story. It's always going to be a story. People that say, get rid of a story, no. There's always a story, you know, how the psyche works, I think. We can but we can get to a point where we understand it's a story, which means it's got some malleability to it. It can change, it's fluid. It's got some fluidity. Anyway, maybe that's enough of it. For this morning, for the theoretical sort of side. I just want to try and give you a sense of what I think it is this morning. Because, you know, sometimes we can come at this in quite different ways. And I think that's really important. You don't get stuck and think, well, this is the spiritual life, or this is Buddhism, this is how it is. I think it's worth saying, you know, personally, one of the things that really attracted me to Buddhism was that it was self-aware, yeah. So it's got this central teaching of a raft, doesn't it? So it realizes that its own teaching is a metaphor. Buddhism is self-aware of its own metaphorical nature. Most religions lose that somewhere down the line. They lose it. And they think it's no longer a metaphor. They think it's relating to some kind of material stroke, spiritual fact, which is kind of fixed, yeah? So this is why they then feel it's fine to go around and persecute heretics or blow up people of other religions or whatever they get up to. Because they forget or they lose the fact that, of course, all of this is a metaphor. That doesn't mean it isn't true. It just means there isn't some single truth. It just means that the truth is always somewhat beyond what you can ever say about it. Yeah? What you can ever say about it. So whenever we express enlightenment or insight, we can only express it through a metaphor. Yeah? I mean, it's self-evidently the case, but of course it's very easy to forget. Yeah? And primarily we get closest to it not through rational argument or rational. We get closest to it, I think, through image, because this is the natural language of the psyche itself, is image, you know, dream, image. Okay. So we're just add just another kind of little. The conceit that we've got, the conceit that I tend to use, is the body as metaphor. So we're using the body as the basic metaphorical ground for trying to practice. We're using our body as the basic, and this is because the body, when we turn towards the body, we find it rich in sensation, emotion, memory, image. All the things that we need seem to be in the body. This is just to say that in the world, because of course our bodies are the most intimate part of the world to us. Yeah. Now what? They're just world, you know, just like that tree out there. It's all world, isn't it? It's all stuff. But this thing we call our body, experience as our body, is the stuff nearest to us. Whether there is an us is, of course, another rude point that we will leave aside for the time being. Yeah? But anyway, it's the stuff that we. So you can't really even talk about this anymore. Well, we are identified with this body. If there's any we to identify with the body, it's another matter, but we won't worry about that at the moment, at least. So we, for the next few days, we're still going to be on this idea. We've been using this image of creating a vessel, and I suggested, Mandava was referring to it last night as well, you can have multiple vessels. I've suggested that the world is a vessel. We can understand the world as a vessel, and that when we lose touch with that, we kind of haven't got any basic stability. That the world as a vessel is a very large open vessel, but when we lose touch with it, we lose our basic stability, we lose our basic grounding, we're kind of lost. When we're not aware of the world, we're kind of lost. It might be usefully lost. We might be lost in a dark wood, as Dante had it, which of course might be very useful. And we'll be talking about this sort of thing. But when we forget the world, there's something radically out of balance, if you see what I mean. You forget the world, what have you got left? This is purely kind of subjective. You become egocentrally the centre of everything. Everything collapses. It's a bit like a black hole. Your world collapses into you. That's not right. It's not right. You know, it's just not right. It's just not how things are. It just doesn't accord with reality. You know, and it tends to be a very painful. Of course, sometimes it can be. Anyway, there's so much we can explore. But because of course we can get hyper-inflated. You know, which of course can be an ecstatic, you know, manic ecstatic, really lovely feeling at the time, and it's sort of the reverse, it's sort of like, it's, in a way it's the same as well. So we're using the idea of this outer vessel of the cosmos or the world just to give a basic stability. And you can use it in a very, very practical, simple way. So when you're meditating and you realize that you've gone into some habitual, negative fantasy or whatever it is that happens to you, just remember the world. Just, it's as simple as that. Remember that the sky above you. Remember through the body, as earth below you. Remember the garden out there. Remember the people. And you just put yourself back in a context. You're in a context. It's very, very simple. It's very, very basic. It's not often taught. It's ridiculous. We're not meditating to collapse into something. We meditate in the world because we live in the world and we manifest in the world and our being is world. So we're not trying to, So it's just so basic. It's just so basic. And in the traditional text, I don't even mention it really, I don't think, because it's taken for granted. I just say go and find a nice tree to sit under. But of course, when they say go and find a nice tree to sit under, what they're doing is evoking the most, the image in a way, the most primal image of this whole process, the tree. I'm sure we'll talk about the tree as we go along. But this idea, if we sit under a tree, we're not sitting under any tree, we're sitting under the world tree, aren't we? This is where the Buddha got enlightened, he's sitting under the world tree. So actually this idea of being in this vessel, being sheltered by this vessel of the world is there in this tree. Yeah? It's there in the tree, he's sitting under the cosmos, he's in the cosmos and it's symbolised by sitting under this tree. So when you get lost, remember the tree, if you like. Yeah. Okay. So that's the first vessel. Then the second vessel, if you like, is the body. And for the next couple of days, we'll just be working with the body. And then maybe there's a more, what we might call an inner vessel, or an esoteric vessel of the heart. Of course, it's part of the body, but again, we're using the heart metaphorically. Which might reveal itself as time goes on. Okay, so we'll just do a little meditation together. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do. Just with our, using our, see what happens, eh? This whole thing, you know, this whole meditation lark and this whole Buddhist lark, it's really an act of imagination, yeah? In essence, that's all we've got, in a sense, our imagination.